Will Not Let Me Go, was written by the Reverend Dr. George Matheson, a celebrated blind preacher of last century. He happened, incidentally, to be a second cousin of my father's. He was asked to propose the toast of Robert Burns. This is his toast. This man is an instrument of 10 strings, of all possible strings. He wears the garb of Scotland, but he is the poet of humanity. His accent is provincial, but his speech is cosmopolitan. He sings in a national dialect, but he delivers a message to man. The hands are the hands of Esau, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. We claim him as the property of our separate land, but in truth, he has made our land universal. This man, in a literary sense, has soared above principalities and powers. He is neither Jew nor Greek, barbarian nor Roman, bond nor free. He is neither Dutch nor German. He is neither, and yet he is all these. He is human. It is on this we base his claim to immortality. This poem is called The Highwayman, written by Alfred Noyes. The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, and the highwayman came riding, 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 the highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. He had a French cocked hat on his forehead, a bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of the claret velvet, and breeches of brown doeskin. They fitted with never a wrinkle. His boots were up to the thigh, and he rode with a jeweled twinkle, his pistol butts a twinkle, his rapier hilt a twinkle, under the jeweled sky. Over the cobbles he clattered and clashed in the dark inn yard, and he tapped with his whip on the shutters, but all was locked and barred. He whistled a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess, the landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. And dark in the dark old inn yard, a stable wicket creaked, where Tim the ostler listened. His face was white and beat. His eyes were hollows of madness, his hair like mouldy hay, but he loved the landlord's daughter, the landlord's red-lipped daughter. Dumb as a dog, he listened, and he heard the robber say, "One kiss, my bonny sweetheart, I'm after a prize tonight, but I shall be back with the yellow gold before the morning light. Yet, if they press me sharply and harry me through the day, then look for me by moonlight, watch for me by moonlight. I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way." He rose upright in his stirrups. He scarce could reach her hand, but she loosened her hair in the casement. His face burnt like a brand as the black cascade of perfume came tumbling over his breast, and he kissed its waves in the moonlight. Oh, sweet black waves in the moonlight. Then he tugged at his rein in the moonlight and galloped away to the west. He did not come in the dawning, he did not come at noon, and out of the tawny sunset, before the rise of the moon, when the road was a gypsy's ribbon, looping the purple moor, a red coat troop came marching, marching, marching. King George's men came marching up to the old inn door. They said no word to the landlord, they drank his ale instead, but they gagged his daughter and bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt at her casement with muskets at their side. There was death at every window, and hell at one dark window, for Bess could see through her casement the road that he would ride. They had tied her up to attention with many a sniggering jest. They had bound a musket beside her with the barrel beneath her breast. "Now keep good watch," and they kissed her. She heard the dead man say, "Look for me by moonlight, watch for me by moonlight, I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way." She twisted her hands behind her, but all the knots held good. She writhed her hands till her fingers were wet with sweat or blood. They stretched and strained in the darkness, and the hours crawled by like years, till now, on the stroke of midnight, cold, on the stroke of midnight, the tip of one finger touched it. The trigger, at least, was hers. The tip of one finger touched it. She strove no more for the rest. Up, she stood up to attention with the barrel beneath her breast. She would not risk their hearing, she would not strive again, for the road lay bare in the moonlight, blank and bare in the moonlight, and the blood of her veins in the moonlight throbbed to her love's refrain. Bit-plot, bit-plot, had they heard it, the horse hooves ringing clear. Bit-plot, bit-plot, in the distance, were they deaf that they did not hear? Down the ribbon of moonlight, over the brow of the hill, the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The red coats glued to their timing. She stood up, straight and still. Flip-flop in the frosty silence, flip-flop in the echoing night. Nearer he came and nearer. Her face was like a light. Her eyes grew wide for a moment. She drew one last deep breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight. Her musket shattered the moonlight, shattered her breast in the moonlight, and warned him that the death. He turned, he spurred to the rescue. He did not know who stood, bowed with her head over the musket, drenched with her own red blood. Not till the dawn he landed, and slowly blanched to hear how best the landlord's daughter, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, had watched for her love in the moonlight and died in the darkness there. Back he spurred like a madman, shrieking a curse to the sky, with the white road smoking behind him and his rapier brandished high. Blood-red were his spurs in the golden moon, wine-red was his velvet coat. Shot him down on the highway, down like a dog on the highway, and he lay in his blood on the highway with the bunch of lace at his throat. And still the winter's night, they say, when the wind is in the trees, when the moon is a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas, when the road is a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, a highwayman comes riding, 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 a highwayman. Up to the old wind door. Over the cobbles he clatters and clangs in the darkened yard, and he taps with his whip on the shutters, the coil, the stock and bar. He whistles a tune to the window, who should be waiting there, but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess, the landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. The Ballad of the Revenge by Tennyson. At Flores in the Azores, Sir Richard Grenville lay, and a pinnace like a fluttered bird came flying from far away. "Spanish ships of war at sea, we have sighted 53. Then swear Lord Thomas Howard, "For God I am no coward, but I cannot meet them here, for my ships are out of gear, and the half my men are sick. I must fly, but follow quick. We are six ships of the line. Can we fight with 53? Then spake Sir Richard Grenville, "I know you are no coward. You fly them for a moment to fight with them again. But I've 90 men and more that are lying sick ashore. I should count myself the coward if I left them, my Lord Howard, to these Inquisition dogs and the devildoms of Spain. So Lord Howard passed away with 5 ships of war that day, till he melted like a cloud in the silent summer heaven. But Sir Richard bore in hand all his sick men from the land, very carefully and slow, men of Biddeford in Devon, and we laid them on the ballast down below, for we brought them all aboard, and they blessed him in their pain that they were not left to Spain, to the thumbscrew and the stake, for the glory of the Lord. He had only 100 seamen to work the ship and to fight, and he sailed away from Flores till the Spaniard came in sight, with his huge sea castles heaving upon the weather bow. Shall we fight or shall we fly? Good Sir Richard, tell us now, for to fight is but to die. There'll be little of us left by the time this sun be set. And Sir Richard said again, we be all good English men. Let us bang these dogs of civil, the children of their devil, for I never turned me back upon don or devil yet. Sir Richard spoke and he laughed, and we roared a hurrah, and so the little Revenge ran on, sheer into the heart of the foe, with 100 fighters on deck and 90 sick below, for half of the fleet to the right and half to the left were seen, and the little Revenge ran on through the long sea lane between. Thousands of their soldiers looked down from their decks and laughed. Thousands of their seamen made mock at the mad little craft running on and on, till delayed by their mountain-like San Philip, that of 1,500 tons and up shadowing high above us with our yawning tiers of guns, took the breath from our sails, and we stayed. And while now the great San Philip hung above us like a cloud, whence the thunderbolt will fall long and loud, 4 galleons drew away from the Spanish fleet that day, and 2 upon the larboard and 2 upon the starboard lay, and the battle thunder broke from them all. But anon the great San Philip, she bethought herself and went, having that within her womb that had left her ill content. And the rest, they came aboard us, and they fought us hand to hand. For 12 times they came with their pikes and musketeers, and 12 times we shook them off as a dog that shakes his ears when he leaps from the water to the land. And the sun went down, and the stars came out far over the summer sea, but never a moment ceased the fight of the 153. Ship after ship, the whole night long, their high-built galleons came, ship after ship, the whole night long, with that battle thunder and flame. Ship after ship, the whole night long, drew back with her dead and her shame. For some were sunk and many were shattered, and so could fight us no more. God of battles, was ever a battle like this in the world before? For he said, fight on, fight on, though his vessel was all but a wreck. And it chanced that when half of the short summer night was gone, with a grisly wound to be dressed, he had left the deck. But a bullet struck him that was dressing it, suddenly dead, and himself he was wounded again in the side and the head. And he said, fight on, fight on. And the night went down, and the sun smiled out far over the summer sea, and the Spanish fleet with broken sides lay round us all in a ring. But they dared not touch us again, for they feared that we still could sting. So they watched what the end would be, and we had not fought them in vain. But in perilous plight were we, seeing 40 of our 400 were slain, and half of the rest of us maimed for life in the crash of the cannonades and the desperate strife. And the sick men down in the hold, were most of them stark and cold, and the pikes were all broken or bent, and the powder was all of it spent, and the mast and the rigging were lying over the side. But Sir Richard cried in his English pride, "We have fought such a fight for a day and a night as may never be fought again. We have won great glory, my men, and a day less or more at sea or ashore we die. What does it matter when? Sink me the ship, Master Gunner, sink her, split her in twain, fall into the hands of God, not into the hands of Spain." And the gunner said, "Aye, aye," but the seaman made reply, "We have children, we have wives, and the Lord hath spared our lives. We will make the Spaniard promise if we yield to let us go. We shall live to fight again and to strike another blow." And the lion there lay dying, and they yielded to the foe. And the stately Spanish men to their flagship bore him then, where they laid him by the mast, old Sir Richard, caught at last. And they praised him to his face with their courtly foreign grace. But he rose upon the decks and he cried, "I have fought for Queen and Faith like a valiant man and true. I've only done my duty as a man is bound to do." With a joyful spirit, aye, Sir Richard Grenville died. And he fell upon the decks and he died. And they stared at the dead that had been so valiant and true, and had holden the power and glory of Spain so cheap, that he dared her with one little ship in his English few. Was he devil or man? Was he devil for aught they knew? But they sank his body with honour down into the deep, and they manned the Revenge with a swarthier alien crew, and away she sailed with her loss, and longed for her own, when a wind from the lands they had ruined awoke from sleep, and the water began to heave, and the weather to moan, and or ever that evening ended, a great gale blew, and a wave like the wave that is raised by an earthquake grew, till it smote on their hulls and their sails and their masts and their flags, and the whole sea plunged and fell on the shot shattered navy of Spain, and the little Revenge herself went down by the island crags to be lost evermore in the main. Puck's Song by Rudyard Kipling. See you the ferny ride that steals into the oak woods far? Oh, that was whence they hewed the keels that rode to Trafalgar. And mark you where the ivy clings to Bairn's mouldering walls? Oh, there we cast the stout railings that stand around St. Paul's. See you the dimpled track that runs all hollow through the wheat? Oh, that was where they hauled the guns that smote King Philip's fleet. Out of the Weald, the secret Weald, men sent in ancient years the horseshoes red at Flodden Field, the arrows at Poitiers. See you our little mill that clacks so busy by the brook? She has ground her corn and paid her tax ever since Doomsday Book. See you our stilly woods of oak and the dread ditch beside? Oh, that was where the Saxons broke on the day that Harold died. See you the windy levels spread about the gates of Rye? Oh, that was where the Northmen fled when Alfred's ships came by. See you our pastures wide and lone where the red oxen browse? Oh, there was a city thronged and known ere London boasted a house. And see you after rain the trace of mound and ditch and wall? Oh, that was a legion's camping place when Caesar sailed from Gaul. And see you marks that show and fade like shadows on the down? Oh, they are the lines the flint men made to guard their wondrous towns. Trackway and camp and city lost, salt marsh where now is corn. Old wars, old peace, old arts that cease, and so was England born. She is not any common earth, water or wood or air, but Merlin's Isle of Gramarye, where you and I will fare.
This was taught me when I was a little girl by my grandfather. Here's to old Scotland, the land of my birth, and the mountains where the wild winds whistle. You can sit for a while on the shamrock and rose, but you canna sit long on the thistle. Now we'll have To a Haggis by Robert Burns. Fair for your honest sonsy face, great chieftain o' the puddin race, abune them all you tak your place, pine straight or fern, will are you worthy or grace, as lang's my erne. The groaning trencher there you fill, your hurdy's like a distant hill, your pin would help to mend a mill in time o' need, while through your pores the dews distill like amber bead. His knife, see rustic, labour dight, and cut ye up with ready slight, trenching your gushing entrails bright like ony dick. And then, oh, what a glorious sift, warm, reeking, rich. Then horn for horn they stretch and strive, deal tack the hindmost, on they drive, till all their well-swalled kites believe are bent like drums. Then old gid man, best like to rive, bethanket, hums. Is there that o'er his French ragout, or olio that would swore sue, or frusca he would mak her spew with simple scanner, looks down with sneering, scornful view on sick a dinner. Pair devil, see him o'er his trash, as feckless as a withered rash, his spindle shank, a gid whip lash, his knee a knit, throw bloody flood or field to dash, oh, how unfit. But mark the rustic, haggis fed, the trembling earth resounds his tread. Clapping his woolly neave a blade, he'll mak it whistle, and legs and arms and heads will snee like taps o' thistles. Ye powers wha mak mankind your care, and dish them out their bill of fare. All Scotland wants nae stinking ware that japs in luggies, but if you wish her grateful prayer, gie her a haggis.
I learned these lines at school. I think they may interest Alison. Never ask for a kiss, she'd be sure to refuse you. Never ask for a kiss, but take my tip for this, just make sure you don't miss, but never ask for a kiss.
Ready? Oh, my love's like a red, red rose, it's newly sprung in June. Oh, my love is like the melody of its sweetly fading tune. As fair thou art, my bonny lass, so deep in love am I, and I will love you still, my dear, through all the seas gang dry. Through all the seas gang dry, my dear, and the rocks melt to the sun, and I will love you still, my dear, while the sands of life will run. And fare thee well, my only love, and fare thee well a while, and I will come again, my love, though it were 10,000 miles.
This always makes me cry, that damn thing.
Play this then.
Yes.
And of course, when I did find the gramophone, it was in a group of people.
There was crying.
Tears streaming down my face.
Have you ever heard this one of London Under Bombardment? Mm-hmm. I think this is a book called Other Men's Flowers, and I just think it is lovely. A girl called Greta Briggs and this man, Lord Wavell, heard this, read it in a paper on his way out to one of the battlefields, and I think it's a really wonderful thing. What is London? Her face stern times before, having fought and ruled and traded for 1,000 years or more. I knew the Roman legions and the harsh-voiced Danish hordes. I knew the Saxon rebels saw blood on the Norman swords. But though I am scarred by battle, my grim defenders vow never was I so stately, nor so well-beloved as now. The lights that burn and glitter in the exile's lonely dream, the lights of Piccadilly and those that used to gleam down Regent Street and Kingsway, may no longer shine, but other lights keep burning, their splendor cool is mine. Seen in the work-worn faces and glimpsed in the steadfast eyes, where little homes lie broken and death descends from the skies, the bombs have shattered my churches, have torn my streets apart, but they have not bent my spirit, and they shall not break my heart. For my people's faith and courage are lights of London town, which still would shine in legions, though my last broad bridge were now. Isn't that wonderful? I get awfully weak when I read poems. I think I should have had a couple of drinks before it. I always have done. Really? We're stupid, aren't we? I think that's too big for you. You better get a bit fatter, love. Don't you?
Yeah, it's got all that.
Well, no, I tell you what, Mummy can put a bit of a nap on the
basket.
Yeah.
Yeah,
easy.
What about
you,
Sophie? No.
Have you got the party key?
No.
No, I'm a Buddhist.
Well, you could have a funny one, couldn't you? When all the papers are fall, we couldn't see far for things. He was stepping it here, he was stepping it there, was paint and paper everywhere. Mother was stuck to the ceiling and the kids were stuck to the floor. Why, you never saw such a blooming family so stuck up before. What about that, eh?
We'll have to get you to tell us about your bake shop.
This was the food.
You don't believe it was the food.
What is about money? She died in the newspaper to start in a good way. And when he died, he left a motor car that she kept.
What sort of motor car?
Horse car.
I
think it was a Denver.
A real
fucker. You want to hear about the funeral of Casti?
Yeah, you can.
But I can't do it without a little help for you.
John,
you want
on.
You want another whiskey?
You're not very observant. Get a move on. Well, that was a nice noise, John. I think that will do, John, because that's my son tonight. And a little water, if you have any water left.
Well, I've
got a bowl of it, all right.
Okay.
Well, my Aunt Bella had 7 sons and 1 daughter. An elder amongst the sons was Alexander, and a younger amongst the sons was Frank. They were very friendly. Alec was a headmaster by profession in a school, while Frank ran a hotel in, what was the name of the place?
Aberfeldy.
Ran it successfully, socially, that from the financial point of view, it was not a good venture.
I mean, he enjoyed the profit.
These two brothers, Alexander and Frank, had a much esteemed aunt called Kirsty McSwarren.
How do you spell Kirsty?
Kirsty, I think, is spelled C-H-U-R-S-K-T-Y.
Never.
But there are several other ways.
You're making this up.
There are several other ways of spelling this.
How do you spell McSwarren?
Max Sporn is easy, it's S-P-O-R-R-A-N, and you all know what that means. Well, their aunt Kirsty died, and a conference was held between Alexander the older and Frank the younger about what to do with Kirsty's body. Kirsty had expressed the wish to be buried at Strontian. Strontian is a village in the west of Scotland from which the element strontium was first discovered. Don't contradict me, Mary. That is a fact, because it is in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, and everything in the early editions of the Britannica is true. Anyway, they got Kirsty's body into a coffin and onto the railway train and accompanied it to the proper railway station somewhere in the west of Scotland, but I'm not quite sure at this date what was the name of the station. When the train stopped, they got the coffin out themselves, but there was some distance between the railway station and the ferry to cross over to Strontian. For this particular purpose, you want to stop it. For this particular purpose of going over the ferry and loading the coffee on the coffin, not the coffee, the coffin on the
boat. The coffee.
The better of it. Onto the boat, they were fortunate in obtaining the service of two or three men who helped them not only to put the coffin on the little rowing boat, but to row over to the other side. Now, Frank, the younger, had his own opinions about the way to treat Highlandmen. Alexander, the older, being a townsman, had a different set of views. And when they got to the other side, Alexander, the older, offered some money to the bearers for their services in conveying the coffin from the one side of the river to the other. With the greatest dignity, these Highland men refused the money from Alec. Frank the younger, having more knowledge, however, without any difficulty, succeeded in persuading the bearers to accept the present of a bottle of whiskey. They then proceeded up the road towards the graveyard, having previously sent a telegram to the superintendent of the graveyard, whoever he may have been, to say that they were coming, but no preparation had been made for the reception of the body. So
So they put the body down near the entrance to the graveyard and walked along the road, where they found a road mender who, on inquiry, said, yes, he was the gravedigger. So they said, well, will you please come now and dig a grave for Aunt Kirsty? And the gravedigger, working at the roadside, said he couldn't come now because the spade that he was working with was his working spade, and he couldn't go and dig a grave unless he had a consecrated spade. And of course that took some time. Finally, however, they all got the grave dug, and there was a great big hole too, because Kirsty was a big woman, and it took a long time, but finally they managed to get a grave dug with a consecrated grave, and everybody was happy.
I can't believe a word of it.
I don't. John says he doesn't believe a word of it, but believe me, it's all true. Whose existence I didn't know. One chap, according to the nearest relatives in a funeral in Scotland, always sit in the first carriage, John. And there was one complete stranger in the first carriage who said, who are you? I said, tell me, who are you? He says, oh, I'm a nephew of the deceased. Said, who are you? I said, I'm a son. Son of the deceased. No, he gave me his name, and I gave him mine, etc., etc. And I said, you're a bachelor, and you're 50? He said, yes, I'm a bachelor. I said, how do you get on without women? He says, I don't, I fall swiles. Well, he was a nice chap.
And you've not met him since?
That's the family you married into, John.
You
missed
that, John.
He was a manager.
I heard.
He was a manager of sewage works in Glasgow. And a very sociable chap.
What can you do with your glass here?
Thank you.
Do you want some water?
What I feel now is that I wish I'd started on some of these things and merely recorded them in writing to help my memory 13, 14, 50 years ago, but I didn't realise their interest or importance in modern terms.
Well, I know what I was going to ask you, just now you were talking about Highlanders. Yeah. Now, do you consider yourself a Highlander?
No.
Well, where do Highlanders then start and where do they end?
Well, my father was a genuine Highlander. He was.
I'm sorry, I meant the name Mackay. Consider that a Highland name?
Oh yes, very definitely, yes.
Even though it is a lowland as far as from a topographical point of view.
No, as far as I'm concerned only, my father was a genuine Highlander, because for generations, as far back as I can trace on either of his own father or mother's side, there was never any marriage between any member of my father's predecessors and a mate south of the Glasgow-Edinburgh line.
So it's a question of the Glasgow-Edinburgh line, not a character of country. Because, am I wrong in thinking that in Sutherland and above is essentially lowland type country?
It's what?
It's essentially low type country. It's not what I would call Highland type country.
Oh, Highland is a geographical area.
Yes, well, this is where I was getting
north of Perth.
If you like. Right.
See, it's the Grampians and north.
Why are you not a Highlander?
Because I was born in Glasgow. I was the result of a union between a Highlander, my father, and a Lowlander, my mother, who was ancestors were around Glasgow and Paisley, which is near Glasgow. And I don't regard myself in terms of a certificate, if you like, as a hand, but sentimentally, emotionally, and